Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, July 31st, 2015, and this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UC Wideout TV. Happy Friday. We finally made it. This probably was the longest week yet for me. I am so glad that it is finally over. It is 75 degrees and sunny here in upstate New York. It finally feels like that humidity that was pushing up from the south has made its way back down south, so I'm hoping it's going to be a nice, comfortable weekend. So, where do we leave off yesterday? Because we're not going to continue on there today. The show yesterday was titled Technocracy, DARPA, and Killer Autonomous Robots. And yeah, there was some pretty crazy stuff we talked about yesterday with that petition that over 1,000 roboticists and artificial intelligence scientists had signed, including some famous people. We heard about Musk, Hawking, Wozniak, it all linked on to keep artificial intelligence and killer robots without any type of human intervention out of the world of war. Today we have a special treat, though. We're going to continue talking about the world of war and the world of technology in regards to possibly some vaccines. We have Mr. Brandon Turville on with us this morning, which is always an awesome treat. Happy Friday, Brandon. How you doing?
Hey, Jules. Thanks for having me on.
I love when you're on Friday. It actually makes for a little change of pace.
And so, thanks for sending that humidity back down south. I can assure you that it has arrived.
Yeah. We actually maybe it was Monday or Tuesday of this week, we had the thermometer out on the deck railing, and I mean, we had like 83% humidity, and in the sun, the thermometer showed 112 degrees, and I did get a picture, so you can have it. Thank you.
So that's pretty much the whole summer down here, so.
I would never, ever be able to handle that. We're cold-blooded up here. I saw a story this morning that you had put out, I think it was from last night, about some of this mandatory vaccination that's going on and some of the lobby groups that are behind it. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that or hop right into Syria, but it was pretty damn interesting who was involved.
Yeah, we could talk about the vaccine thing first and then maybe move into Syria. I think this might be surprising to a lot of people. We've seen this push for laws regarding mandatory vaccination all across the country, and it's been in a number of different states simultaneously. Some states have given those bills more traction. Some have actually passed them. Some have voted them down. But it's been happening all across the country. And whenever you see something like that, you know immediately or should know immediately that this is a coordinated agenda. It's a plan. It's not just organic a reaction to some type of news story. It's not some coincidence that this is a actually coordinated campaign to promote mandatory vaccination. I'm sure your listeners already know all that, but we had the situation in California. We've had a situation in Vermont, in North Carolina. And these are just a few examples. We've had several other places where the bills maybe didn't get as much attention or either they got voted down, but these are the areas where people might be more familiar with them. And I think that when you look around at the media, you see, you know, the opposition to vaccination or anti-vaxxers, as some of us might be called, has been pretty bipartisan, right? You could find people who question vaccines or maybe aren't a big fan of vaccines in conservative areas. You can find them in liberal groups. You know, it's across the board. It's not something that typically one group adheres to. And granted, it is a minority, but it's a minority that spans political parties and political ideologies. Now, what you saw with this propaganda campaign to promote mandatory vaccination was this appeal to scientism, you know, this obsessive religious worship of anything that's deemed science, regardless of whether it is or not, which is very much appealing to sort of the left part of the paradigm, is the, you know, the trendies, the little hipsters, hipster scientists and stuff who it's cool to be a nerd and cool to be a biologist and that type of thing. So it appeals to that segment. And this actually false narrative that vaccines have been proven safe and effective, of course, is taken on within because of the propaganda narrative. And none of them were even talking about vaccines until the media began to really hit this thing pretty hard.
Right,
Now,
when Johnny's Disney World vacation was ruined with measles, and then I don't know if it was before or after that we had the quote unquote Ebola outbreak here. That's really what kind of fired everything up, I believe.
yeah, I think Ebola was first. I'm not really sure. It was definitely a 1-2 punch, right? Because you had Ebola, the deadly killer that was going to spread across the world, and then you mixed it with measles, and then
Right. Ebola was first, yes. And then they made measles seem like it was even worse than Ebola. Oh my God, like no one ever had a case of the measles in the past before.
yeah, and of course, the reason it spread was because of these stupid anti-science Luddites who didn't vaccinate their kids, even though I believe that most of those kids were vaccinated, but not really positive on that. But regardless, that's the narrative, right? That if you don't support vaccines, then you are anti-science, you are a Luddite, and you're probably a Republican, and that's obviously not true. But of course, the left has really grasped onto this. The right has too, but particularly the left has really grabbed onto this with two hands in their teeth to attack anybody that's seen as anti-science. And what's ironic about that is one of the major lobbying groups that have been behind this push for mandatory vaccination is ALEC. And if anybody knows anything about ALEC, if you're on the right, you probably don't know anything about ALEC because, or Koch Industries. But if you're on the left, that is the that's the head of the snake for you because basically what it is, the American Legislative Exchange Council is what this is, and it's considered a non-profit organization. It's made up of conservative state legislators, corporate heads, banking heads, big pharmaceutical companies, big industrial companies, banks, that sort of thing. They're all part of this council. It's a mixture of government officials and corporate agents and banking agents, and they meet regularly and they discuss legislation that they'd like to see go through Congress, and they even write the legislation for the congressman. They submit it to the congressman, and the congressman takes that back to Congress and submits it to Congress. So in one sense, it's this big corporate lobbying firm, but it's actually more than that because they actually write the legislation and give it to the congressman who's a member, and then the congressman goes in who receives funding from ALEC because they get these stipends and that type of thing, which really is just bribes. They go in and they submit the legislation. They've got a pretty good record, I think, out of the bills that they submit, that ALEC submits through their puppet congressman. They get about 20% of them enacted. So it's kind of a shotgun method. You submit 1,000 bills, you get 20% of them, and that's pretty good, And it's usually focuses on the state level. It's not so much federal as much as it is at the state level. They get these bills passed at the state level. And that's what we've seen in terms of the mandatory vaccination. So I just wanted to point out the irony there that for any leftist who supports these mandatory vaccinations bills, congratulations, genius. You just fell for Koch Industries and you just fell for ALEC. Way to go. Way to be politically astute because you just fell for what you would consider to be the other side of the aisle and its propaganda campaign. So congratulations, guys, once again. But but this seriously is a major issue, obviously, not just to rub it into people who fell for what they would consider propaganda from the other end of the aisle, right? These guys are really dangerous. ALEC is really dangerous. And again, Koch Industries, for people who don't know what Koch Industries is, they call themselves Coke, right? Really, this is the old German name Koch, so we'll call them Koch. These major industrialists, they've made money through asset stripping and through abusing employees and labor in general and just ripping to shreds the labor force. They're major industrial corporation firms and that sort of thing. And it's the Koch family is what's largely in charge of that. And they are essentially the bankrollers of ALEC. So if you look at ALEC and Koch Industries as sort of the right-wing version of George Soros on the left wing, and that's pretty much that's a good way to look at it, I think. Just to give you an idea of who's on the board of ALEC, though, I got a list. We won't go through all of them, but companies like Bayer, DuPont, Eli Lilly. We've also got GlaxoSmithKline, La Roche, Hoffman La Roche, and Johnson & Johnson, Novo Nordisk, Pfizer, Purdue Pharma. A lot of these, the Upjohn Corporation, Upjohn Company, and we've got a bunch of corporations that are actually conglomerates of big pharmaceutical agencies that are on these boards.
So no conflict of interest there, of course.
Well, it's not necessarily that it's even a conflict of interest because ALEC is not, obviously not a government organization. It's pretty open about what it wants to do, right? It's open in one sense that it's a council of, bringing corporate heads and congressmen together, but it's very secretive in terms of their meetings because of the way they're set up. They don't have to, publish the minutes of their meetings. They don't have to publish necessarily how much money is given out. And what they're discussing and what they plan to do. Some of those draft bills, though, are online, and I link to them in my article. So, yeah, they're made up of major pharmaceutical companies, and that's just one aspect of it, right? They're also made up of things like Coca-Cola, major corporations. Basically, it's an umbrella organization for a lot of major corporations. And they're not just on, one specific aspect. These guys are about pharmaceutical corporations, maybe, I don't know, Big Coal, or I don't know. Just pick a major corporation, and it's in there, in ALEC, and you can go Google search some of this to see if they're members, and it won't take you that long to find it because they've got all these different councils within the council, and it contains a lot of different members. Now, remember that ALEC. What for people who don't know this, ALEC was the group that crafted model legislation. Again, model legislation is the bill. They craft it and hand it to the senator and say, "Hey, we'd like a bill like this. Don't you think this would be a good idea?" And he just takes the copy and submits it to Congress. But the bill that they helped craft was immunization of minors on TANF. And this was legislation that would have required anybody on TANF, that's temporary assistance to needy families. It's a sort of a welfare program. It's what when Clinton cut welfare, they renamed a portion of welfare TANF, and that's what this is. And it's essentially requiring anyone on TANF to provide proof that their children were fully vaccinated according to the recommended levels. And if those families didn't show proof of their child's vaccinations, the families would lose their TANF benefits. And that's, of course, that was really and that was really something that the right could get behind because that involved, ripping benefits away from people or ripping money from people that they hate. So this was, again, model legislation that actually got some submitted and it didn't get passed, and it maintained the exemptions, but that's just an example. So we, if you take a look at Vermont, they had this bill SB 199, and that caught a lot of people in Vermont by complete surprise. And it was a bill that would have removed the philosophical exemption to vaccination. And when you take a look at the players that were involved, you see who submitted the bill, and it was Kevin Mullen. And Kevin Mullen was in the Vermont House, and he was the Vermont chair of ALEC, right? And so you can see where this is coming from. He was, there was another individual, I believe, that was involved in that as well, that was linked to ALEC. And of course, some big pharmaceutical companies also helped fund that individually. Then we have the situation in California, the SB 277 bill, and that was introduced by two different congressmen. One of them was Richard Pan. This guy is this, I call him in the article, a high priest of the religion of scientism, right? He's what every trendy loves. He's a politician parasite, but he's also a medical doctor because he cares so much about people that he ran for office. And he helped submit the bill in one branch of the California Senate. And his friend Ben Allen, which was the second state senator to introduce the bill, was also connected to ALEC. And in pretty clear ways, right? He had the donations from William E. Obendorf, or Oberndorf, I'm sorry. He's a billionaire out in California who's an investor. He funds a bunch of conservative causes and like the privatization of education, that sort of thing. And he is a major member of ALEC, and this is where Ben Allen got his funding as well. And then we come to North Carolina and we see Jeff Tart. And if anybody who listens to my show might remember the name Jeff Tart, because we made relentless fun of this arrogant piece of garbage in North Carolina, because he was submitting a bill, SB 346, that would have eliminated not only the philosophical exemption but the religious exemption to vaccination for children entering North Carolina public schools. But that bill also would have eliminated those exemptions, period. And essentially, the way the bill was set up, it would have included homeschool children. It wasn't just children going into public schools, it was all children in North Carolina. So even homeschool children would have to be forcibly vaccinated, according to Tart's bill. And now, it's not advertised on the ALEC website that I could see, and it's not something that's readily available. But Jeff Tart has a newsletter, and if you signed up to the newsletter, you would have seen that he's a member of ALEC, and he gave a number of speeches at ALEC conferences, the Spring Task Force Summit, where he gave a speech and actually bragged about his participation with ALEC in his newsletter. And I've got screenshots of his newsletter in my article. So again, I don't mean to promote ALEC as the head of the snake for all things related to medical tyranny, but it's a major participant. And I cannot get past the irony that the major portion of people who supported the mandatory vaccination bills were leftists, when in fact, the lobbying group that was pushing these mandatory vaccination bills were the alleged right-wing Koch Industries and ALEC. So I want to rub that in just a little bit. But I think people should definitely take a look at these groups if you've never heard of them before, because they're a powerful, powerful group of people.
Yeah, New York State has really been pushing the vaccine agenda as well. Right at the very end of last school year, a letter arrived home stating that they've now decided to make the meningitis vaccine mandatory for all school children as well. And I'm just looking at a story here where one of the legislators was pointing out the fact that we only get one or two cases of meningitis in New York State a year, which is exactly what I had mentioned when I saw that, but that 10% of all recipients of the vaccine actually have adverse reactions. So by giving children mandatory meningitis vaccines, we're actually going to have 4 to 6 cases or more a year that are injured by the vaccine versus the one or two that they end up getting naturally in the state. You know what I mean? I'd love to see who was behind this.
Yeah, that would be something to look at, because it seems like this could be something coming from the pharmaceutical industries. It could be coming from ALEC, and again, they're one and the same. And don't mistake the fact that these companies who are a member of ALEC don't fund Democrats and leftists either. Of course they do. This is just a different manifestation of that type of funding. But yeah, the meningitis vaccine, meningitis is incredibly rare. So now that they're going to try to mandate that, get ready for there to be more cases. And who's going to get blamed when there are more cases of meningitis? Oh, the anti-vaxxers, the crazy anti-vaxxers. That's why we had this problem to begin with. We had it eradicated, right?
Exactly.
Even though we didn't have mandatory vaccines for it. But hey, history's never got in the way of a good propaganda campaign.
Well, you know, one of the other things I found interesting is during the quote unquote bird flu outbreak that overtook much of the northern states that were well known for their chickens, like Iowa, and that. I don't know if you saw that. It didn't really make a lot of headlines, but they lo and behold, in the midst of this massive outbreak that caused the price of eggs to go sky high, they now have come out with a bird flu vaccine for chickens and turkeys. And a lot of the farmers were against the vaccination because it seems that the farmers seem to know more than most of these scientists. They talked about virus shedding in vaccinated chickens. But, I mean, that also has been found to happen with many of the other live vaccines that we give to our children. They shed for a few weeks at least after receiving the vaccination and can be contagious to those who have not had it. You had some story, speaking about chickens, I did not get a chance to read it, but I was really curious about your chicken ID law in North Carolina. What was that about?
That actually was not my story. That story was by Heather Callahan at Natural Blaze, and I posted it on my website. But essentially, the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services is taking this flu outbreak that you just mentioned, this bird flu outbreak, and they're requiring all chicken operations to have a barcode for their chickens. And all right, well, while on the face of it, just that description, you go, all right, well, all right, if you got a chicken operation, have a barcode. The idea behind this is that they want to be able to alert poultry owners about the outbreaks. If there's an outbreak, they can just, you know, alert these people. Not sure what a barcode, how that's going to work, but that's the premise behind it. The major problem, however, is that they're going after people who have just a couple chickens in their backyard for eggs for breakfast, or you know, maybe they got 10 chickens and they sell eggs to a neighbor or to a couple friends. So they want these guys to have barcodes, which essentially means that if there's a bird flu outbreak, they can come by. And when they say alert poultry owners, what they mean is they come in and kill their chickens.
Right, with the National Guard and foam like they did in Minnesota.
Yeah, it's a pretty cruel way to kill them, too.
It is.
But that's what they do. That's what they mean. Do you think they're going to go in and kill all the Tyson chickens? Of course not. They're going to go get Joe Bob, who's got his 10 chickens in the back of his yard, who sells to his friends and his family, and they're going to kill his chickens, despite the fact that almost all of the outbreaks of bird flu have come from factory farm operations. And the reason it comes from factory farm operations is because these chickens are forced to live in these horrible conditions in their own feces. And that's why you get bird flu. Anybody farming 100 years ago could have told you that would have caused disease. Anybody with common sense would have known that that is what would have caused disease. And the people who get this bird flu are people who handle the birds. So, there's a bit of panic over bird flu. And what this is, in my opinion, is that they are attempting to first register everyone with a backyard chicken, a small chicken operation, organic chickens and so forth, get them registered, put them down, documented. And then when there's a nice panic ensuing, they can come around and they can eliminate all these birds. And if you eliminate 10 chickens or 100 chickens or 1,000 chickens from Tyson, that's not a huge deal. But if you eliminate 10 of the 10 birds this guy has in his backyard operation, he's done. So I think that's one of the major reasons that they're doing this. And there's an activist in North Carolina, Nicole Revels, who has been on my show before talking about the vaccine bill, actually, is now fighting this backyard chicken ID program. And apparently this is a major push, and this is not something that's just going to be stopped with a few letters, and that this is something that is really being pushed by the powers that be and the Department of Agriculture in North Carolina. So we'll be talking more about that probably on either my next show or the show after that. But the article is North Carolina requiring barcodes for backyard chicken owners. And I've got that up at BrandonTurberville.com. It's also up at NaturalBlaze.com, so people can go check out those links there. But it's pretty concerning.
Yeah, it's very frightening considering that, you know, having your own backyard flock, even if you weren't selling it to friends and neighbors, is a great way to fight back against, you know, all the poisoning of our food, the fact that they just got rid of all the country of origin labeling on pork, beef, chicken. I mean, you saw that. They also approved being able to ship chickens to China for processing and have them be shipped back. You know, I mean, it's kind of a crazy it's a kind of a crazy world right now where there really isn't any type of safety in our food. The FDA isn't keeping their eye out for anything that would protect us. I mean, even going back to vaccines and that pseudoscience you were talking about, you know, we did a couple stories here a few months back just about how there's a large majority now of any of the scientific studies that are out there is being fraudulent, and the FDA never redacted any of them when they were proven to be fraudulent. So there's none of that science that can even be trusted, and these anti-vaxxers that are standing up screaming, pointing to studies to say this, that, and the other thing, and how anti-vaxxers are so crazy, are basing everything upon science that can't be trusted in any way, shape, or form.
Well, that's why it's a religion. That's why I refer to it as religion, because if you have a religion, you essentially believe in things that you believe, but you can't prove. Mm-hmm. And that's what the vaccine science is. So you believe it works, but you don't have any evidence to show that it does. And if somebody said that about some type of religious philosophy, they would say, oh, look, that person's living in the Stone Age, like he believes in sky gods and stuff like that. But if you say, well, I believe vaccines work, even though there's been no evidence to show that they do, then all of a sudden you're considered a brilliant scientist and you're credible in some way. It's just one religion, one more religion, that seeks to perpetuate itself. So it's faith-based science. That's all it is. And in fact, if you post up articles regarding vaccinations or genetically modified food and stuff, then you'll notice that you get instantly attacked by a lot of different people. And some of them, I guess, are real people with nothing to do but comment on articles online. But there are a lot of them who are actually either computer programs or they're people who get paid to sit in a cubicle somewhere and start fights in chat rooms and on Facebook, social media, Twitter, or comment sections and articles. So that's why I want to encourage everybody listening, don't argue with the trolls, because they are there for the purpose of pulling you off of the topic. They want to get you in a fight for hours so you waste your time that you could have been doing something productive. Thought I'd throw that in there for free, because I see a lot of people who will engage in arguments with people online for hours and hours and hours, and you look at the argument and you think, well, you know, you could have written two articles with that diatribe that you put there, but instead you were arguing with a computer program, and that is all put out for the purpose of creating a sense of inevitability, a sense of public consensus that vaccines are good, that genetically modified food are safe, and that most people accept them as safe. Because if you continually put out what appears to be other people saying that they support vaccines, they support GMOs, then you automatically think you're in the minority and that you better shut up, and it's self-perpetuating. So it's really kind of a technique of mind war that we talked about here on the show before this, that research paper, Mind War, from PsyOps to Mind War, by Michael Aquino and Paul Villele. This sense of inevitability comes through. Once you get a sense of inevitability, most people just throw up their hands and throw in the white flag. So don't necessarily be fooled by the propaganda. Now, people are malleable in this country, believe me or not. Believe it or not, you can see it for yourself. They are malleable and believe any stupid thing that they're told. But at the same time, you shouldn't accept this inevitability mechanism.
Right, and the majority of the public are a bunch of lemmings. You know, they don't do their own research, which is the sad part of it. But, I mean, even the research that's out there, you need to dig very deep and use your brain on top of it all, because you can't believe everything you're told. I mean, it's a very sad state we have now. So talking about believing what we're told, there's so much garbage coming out of the Middle East right now. What on earth is going on? I saw Turkey has now started bombing inside Syria, and they're setting up a no-fly zone. I think your last story had talked about what is going on over there.
Oh, well, it's not a no-fly zone. It's an ISIL-free zone. You see, yeah, you see how the name change makes it completely something different than what it is?
Yes.
It went from no-fly zone to buffer zone to safe zone to humanitarian zone. Now it's an ISIL-free zone. I guess we'll have a ISIL diet version or something. It sounds like a Coke product or something. But essentially, What's happened, this really started, and again, they've been pushing for a buffer zone for years now. That was exactly what happened in Libya when they created this no-fly zone. Gaddafi was putting up a good fight against the terrorists that were funded by the West until they declared the no-fly zone. And then they, of course, to enforce a no-fly zone, you have to attack the Air Force. You can't just put your planes up in the air and trust the opposing army not to fly its planes or trust that it won't shoot you down. You have to attack its anti-aircraft missiles and you have to attack its air force. And that's what they did with Gaddafi, and that sealed Gaddafi's fate. That's what they want to do with Assad. Now, the real catalyst for the Turkish involvement was this bombing in Suruk. This was a demonstration by largely Kurdish people. It was a demonstration. They wanted to provide assistance to Kobani, or it's Ayn al-Arab in Syria. They wanted to provide humanitarian assistance and help rebuild. This is the Kurdish area. It wasn't really a protest. It was just a demonstration. And then a suicide bomber detonates a bomb in the middle of the demonstration, and this person was allegedly connected to ISIS. Now, unlike Americans who would immediately start shaking in their boots and demanding that we start nuking random countries, the Turks knew exactly who was responsible. They looked at Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and said, you control ISIS. You did this to us. big difference there. But the PKK, which is the Kurdish militia in Turkey, responded by killing two Turkish police officers that the PKK claims were affiliated with ISIS. And then, of course, we had a crackdown by Turkey on some of the Kurds in the southeastern part of Turkey, and we're starting to see a flare-up of violence. And this was something that I, warned about a couple of years ago, which is that if Erdogan continued to work with the United States and NATO, of which is a part, and if it continued to work with these organizations in trying to destabilize Syria and promote ISIS, that it was going to find that itself was going to be destabilized because the Kurds were going to start straightening up their backs as the Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian Kurds started doing the same. So that's the fruits of Erdogan's labor. So we now have Turkey claiming that it was going to crack down on ISIS, and we had these major operations across Turkey arresting so-called ISIS members and launching bombing campaigns inside Syria against ISIS targets. And we'll come back to that in a minute because there's really not much evidence that these bombings have been very effective at all, and they've actually not been aimed at ISIS so much as just sort of death squad herding. In other words, bombing areas where ISIS may be at, but pushing them deeper into Syrian territory. So it's kind of a primitive form. It's like rustling cattle, basically. This is what the U.S. had been doing in Iraq and Syria when they started their bombing campaign, which was essentially herding death squads. If they got too close to the Western oil fields, then they'd get bombed for real. If they didn't and they wanted to push them further into Iraq or further into Syria, it would be bombed essentially around those areas. The death squad fighters would leave sometimes the day before. It's funny, these ISIS fighters seem to get intelligence the day before a bombing takes place so they can get out and they can go deeper into this territory. But aside from that bombing, we also see Turkey going after the Kurds in Syria and Iraq, particularly Iraq, because Iraq Kurds are more aligned with the PKK. So they're bombing the Iraqi Kurds, and they have launched a very intensive bombing campaign against them. I mean, this dwarfs anything that was even related at all to the ISIS bombing, the death squad herding, and that should tell you enough right there. Now, the question of the ISIL free zone. This was something that happened before the bombing started taking place. This was about a week ahead of time. Turkey and the United States had been discussing plans to create a no-fly zone. And of course, Obama comes out and says, oh, no, we're not going to do a no-fly zone. That's just that we don't want any more confrontation. And Turkey says they want a no-fly zone. Well, the agreement is to have an ISIL free zone, which that's a no-fly zone. So If you look on the map, and I've got that in one of my articles, and I'll have another one coming out here hopefully in a couple of hours that people can see on the map. It goes to the as far east as Jarablus, and as far west as I'm trying to think of the name of the town now. It escapes me, but it's past Kobane, right? I really wish I could remember the name of the town.
That's okay.
Dabik, that's it. I knew it started with a D. All right, so it goes about as far east as Jarablus and as far west as Dabik. And it goes about 40 to 50 miles deep into Syria. Now, this does not span the entire northern Syrian border. This doesn't go from coast to Iraq. This goes from Jarablus to Dabiq. This is sort of a small no-fly zone. But look on the map at where these places are, and then look on some of the other maps that are available so you can see the supply lines of ISIS coming in from Turkey, because that's where they've mostly been coming in from Turkey.
Right.
Look at where that's at. It's the last few supply lines that have not been taken over by the Kurds. The Kurds have taken over from Jarablus all the way to the Iraqi border. The Kurds control that. They've cut the ISIS supply lines coming across from Turkey from that entire eastern area. Then they've also, from around about Dabiq in the west all the way to the coast, they've controlled that as well. The only thing they have left to take control of is this area in the middle. And once they take control of that area in the middle, ISIS is cut off. ISIS doesn't have any more supply routes that can get to Raqqa. The only place that they could get supplies would be coming in sort of a roundabout way through Iraq or up through Jordan and Israel, which is becoming increasingly difficult to do because in those areas, the Syrian military has cracked down on the southern and southeastern borders of Syria, right, with Jordan and Israel. So the Syrian military has essentially got that on lock. They can't come in from from Lebanon's border because Hezbollah and the Syrian military have cracked down on that. So they've only got this one tiny area where they can come in, and the Kurds were about to launch an operation against this area. Now, look at the map of this small area that ISIS has supply routes, the area where the Kurds do not have control, and the area where the ISIL free zone will be. It's the same area. So in other words, what this is an emergency method to protect ISIS and protect the supply routes and keep those supply routes open, because if the Kurds cut them off, it's over for ISIS. They're completely locked. And then it's a matter of they're essentially surrounded. It's a matter of just pushing into these areas and wiping them out. And most of these areas, Raqqa, for instance, that's nothing but desert. People make too much of that in terms of land mass. It's really just a big giant desert, so it's not something that's strategically that important. So that's what you can look at with the ISIL free zone. All of this is just theater, but it's a theater to protect ISIS and keep those supply routes going. And the United States and Turkey now, they're saying that it's not a no-fly zone, right? They're just going to bomb ISIS and make sure ISIS isn't in this area anymore. Well, here's the question. If it's not a no-fly zone, does that mean that Assad can fly jets in this area now? Because he's the only one with the Air Force in Syria. What would happen if Assad flies jets? This is on his territory. So what would happen if Assad would fly jets into the ISIL-free zone and actually bomb ISIS? What would happen? Would they shoot him down? Because that's a no-fly zone. And of course they would shoot him down. And that's pretty clear. So that's what you have to look at. Also, there's also this question of the Kurdistan issue. And the Kurds are this sort of ethnic minority who span Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria. And they've all expressed interest in autonomy. They've all expressed interest in independence. And in Turkey, they fought a bloody battle for years, for decades, really, going back to the early 80s. And it was really a horrible experience, right? A lot of the Turkish soldiers have this is like the Turkish Vietnam, right? This was this left a lot of those guys really, really damaged with PTSD and that sort of thing. It really destroyed most of that southeastern portion of Turkey that are the Kurdish territories, and it really did a number on the country as a whole. And there were several attempts at peace deals back in the late 90s, and then again, I think in 2013, and each time they kind of come unraveled, and we're seeing that come unraveled again. But this is an example. When Erdogan agreed to work with NATO and the U.S. to funnel the ISIS terrorists in, then the Kurds in Syria naturally aligned themselves with the Assad government, and the Iraqi Kurds aligned themselves with the Iraqi government, and the Iraqi and Syrian Kurds aligned themselves with each other naturally. Well, the PKK in Turkey, the Kurdish groups there, naturally aligned themselves with Iraq and Syrian Kurds, right? And this frightens Turkey because Turkey sees that if all these groups of Kurds get together and start working together, particularly as a military force, then that means he's got a unified military force on his border with a large portion of those who want autonomy. He could lose the southeastern portion of Turkey, or at least have to engage in some type of major military battle again. So this is, again, the benefit of having a nitwit like Erdogan in power is that he doesn't understand, or maybe he does understand, just doesn't care. He's an Islamist, but he is willing to play this this gambit. When they had peace, he's willing to risk it all, and now you can see it coming undone. So you might see Turkey involved in some type of major military occupation and confrontation in its own borders in the very near future as well. So they're very worried about Kurdistan, which is also that's how the Kurds are generally used for intelligence operations from NATO, which they have been used from intelligence operations in NATO, particularly the Iraqi Kurds, is they've always been tempted with this idea of a Kurdistan. And whether or not that will actually ever happen is something to be that remains to be seen. But just one other question here about this this ISIL free zone. I want to point out that they're saying ISIS needs to be eradicated from the zone, but the zone, Turkey says the zone is going to be filled with refugees, so they won't have to go into Turkey. They'll have a safe zone that they can go into. Syrian refugees can go into this ISIL free zone. But there's also they're also going to encourage the moderate rebels to populate the free zone and take control of that. Well, if anybody's listened to my show or listened or read my articles, you'll know that there are no moderate rebels. If when NATO says moderate rebels, they mean ISIS. So this ISIS free zone should be called an ISIS free range zone, because all this is the Air Force protection of ISIS. So they call it the FSA, they could call it Harakat Hazam, they could call it Jabhat al-Nusra, they could call it whatever they want. It's the same thing. It's ISIS. And again, name changes. ISIL free zone versus safe zone or buffer zone, ISIS versus Jabhat al-Nusra, doesn't matter. It's all the same thing. And it's going to be used as a forward operating base against Assad, because once they come in and declare this zone and make sure the Syrian military is not in the zone, make sure the Kurds are not in the zone, make sure that the supply routes are open, you'll see ISIS being pushed further and deeper into Syrian territory. So that's essentially what's taking place right now in Syria.
Now, is the U.S. in there? I know we had seen a while back that we had crossed over and had started bombing in regards to quote unquote chasing ISIS. I mean, are we still doing that? I haven't seen anything about the U.S. and bombing in Syria lately.
Yeah, we're still, the U.S. is still there and still bombing in Iraq and Syria. The bombing campaigns have not been as heavy recently. I suppose they've got their ISIS forces wherever they wanted to position them. That's why it's slacked off a bit. But the bombing is continuing because there's still, civilians to bomb, and there's still, Syrian infrastructure to bomb. Remember, too, that a lot of the Iraqis have reported that these American planes will come over and drop weapons to ISIS, And there's been the bombing is still continuing, along with the big accidents where they accidentally bombed the Iraqi forces, or they accidentally bombed the Kurds, or accidentally bombed somebody they're supposed to be helping. But yeah, it's continuing, and the U.S. will soon be over the northern part of Syria as well.
And another thing, Erdogan, is he a Western puppet, or is he someone that we've managed to pull on our side with a dangling carrot? I mean, in Turkey and Jordan, we've talked about this before, that's really kind of where, when the guns started flowing out of Libya and across, we had all the jailbreaks across the Middle East before ISIS became an issue at the time. We had heard some stories where the CIA was doing trainings right in Jordan and Turkey for these quote unquote moderate rebels that we were then going to funnel. I mean, is Erdogan a part of our team, or is he someone that we've just kind of coaxed to play along?
Yeah, he's absolutely a part of the team. Remember, Turkey's a part of NATO, and Erdogan has been working with the U.S. and NATO since day one. He's got this sort of strange grandeur of delusion that he's a delusion of grandeur, sorry, that he's becoming, the Turkey's going to have the new Ottoman Empire, and that he's going to be the head of it. And as you can see, that is not the case. And he should have known this to begin with. But he's an entirely Western-backed puppet. He's definitely had that dangling carrot of the new Ottoman Empire that has been dangled in front of him. But he's a puppet. I mean, he's the Turkish government is largely. Well, it's about 50-50. There's secular, reasonable people, and then there's the Islamists, and Erdogan is one of the Islamists. And he's been backed by the U.S. He's been supported by the U.S. So yeah, he's 100% on the team of NATO, on the NATO team. So yeah, I would there's no question that Turkey is part of the NATO team.
I never trust Turkey, that's what I always say.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people would have that same outlook, especially throughout history. And the Jordanians, again, the Jordanians were the base where a lot of these ISIS fighters were trained. Remember, they had tens of thousands of fighters on the ground that were being trained, as was reported in the European press, but not here. These fighters then went on. They went on to Turkey, and then through Turkey they came into to Syria, and this major operation, a major push to get them in the country, and they did so with Turkish air support and Israeli air support on the other end of the country to create a diversion, which is how they got in there. And it turns out that those fighters were ISIS fighters. They weren't moderate rebels, because they don't exist. They were ISIS fighters. Then we saw the name ISIS start popping out. But yeah, again, always remember that Erdogan is a total creation or puppet of NATO. One other thing I should mention here, because I know we're running close to the end of the show, but this question of buffer zones has been discussed for some time by not just by national governments, but by military industrial complex firms like the Brookings Institution, and they've got. Several articles. There's one assessing options for regime change, and this was back in 2012, where they talked about creating buffer zones. They said what they argued for was a propaganda campaign that was based around humanitarian access, the humanitarian crisis, and then that would lead to the creation of safe zones and humanitarian zones or humanitarian corridors, which are basically no-fly zones, which would be backed by U.S. military power and NATO military power. So that's been discussed for some time. The other aspect of it is to create a multi-front war. And this is the idea that if you can keep Assad trying to balance back and forth, keep him off kilter, if you get the Israelis constantly pushing in on their end of the border, bombing, funneling ISIS in, which they do, and occasionally lopping missiles over to the side of onto the Syrian side, you can also get the Turks to funnel in ISIS, to move in closer, and posture military forces on the border to launch occasional bombing raids across to the Syrian side. You create this multi-front war, and you keep Assad off balance, right? He's constantly having to respond to the Israelis. He's having to respond to the Turks. He's having to respond to ISIS and all these other places. So you keep him off kilter, and eventually you're able to sort of, pitch the territory down and clamp down around his throat. That's also been talked about by the Brookings Institution in 2012, and that's also what you see. You remember Israel just bombed Syria a couple of days ago. They just bombed them again. So you see Turkey and Israel working in close coordination here.
I was going to ask you, too, about Israel. I just saw after the Iran deal that we turned around and gave Israel millions of dollars more support for weapons and such. What do you think of that? Wasn't Bibi complaining about the Israeli deal?
Well, yeah, Bibi always complains. He's always ready and willing to fight to the last American on any issue. It's like most countries are always ready to fight to the last American. You know, it's funny, The Onion a couple of years ago wrote an article and said it was a, an Onion satire. So they were saying that, basically that Bibi was throwing a fit. So the U.S. gave him a few billion dollars and a few missiles to make him feel better. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I saw that. And, I think actually it wasn't even a few years before. It was like a day or two before the story hit the presses.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah,
it was even better. So, it's you try to satirize reality now. It's putting satirists out of business.
Absolutely.
The Israelis, by the way, have been talking about working with the Saudis in a strike against Iran. And there's an article up in the Jerusalem Post and a couple of other Israeli news agencies. If you'll look at the climate in Israel in terms of the media, in terms of the pulse of the media, what you'll see is that the Israeli press is pushing this idea of, should we bomb Iran now, or should we wait until it's a catastrophe and then we have to defend ourselves and maybe get nuked? It's almost like the propaganda that came out before the Iraq war, right? They have weapons of mass destruction. We have to bomb them now or there'll be a mushroom cloud and all that kind of stuff. And granted, the Israeli press is always repeating this nonsense, but they've really been going to full court press lately, suggesting that there's it's not an option of if they should bomb, it's an option. The question is when they should bomb. Should they bomb before the UN codifies a lot of this, gets rid of these resolutions? Because this process with the Iran deal is that Iran meets a goal, and then some sanctions are removed as well. And it's this process that's going to go on for several months, maybe even a year. So the question is, do they attack now before the resolutions are off? They can claim it's a preemptive strike, and once the resolution that removes Iran as a violator of some different treaties, then they can legally claim, well, we lost a preemptive strike against a country that is a violator, right? Once you remove that resolution, then they attack the country that's not a violator. But so there's always these legal, technicalities that they're trying to discuss in terms of how we could legally justify an attack on Iran and could we do it. And the Saudis apparently have indeed talked with the Israelis in terms of how they could do this, how the Saudis could help support doing that. So it's apparent that the Israelis really really want to go ahead with this. And again, the Israelis don't really have to worry about the legal aspect of it, because if they do it, they've got the biggest bully in the world behind them. And the United States is going to support them no matter what, whether they bomb Iran. I mean, do we really expect the United States to condemn Israel for bombing a country that did nothing to them after we've done that how many times in the last 10 years?
Right.
So it's really the same policy. We the U.S. really couldn't criticize them for that, and they wouldn't. They would come to their aid if there would be any type of military confrontation there. So I think that we may see some type of strike in the future, but I'm not going to predict that because things can rapidly change. I mean, just look at the Greek situation, that things can go to the brink and they can come back just as quick.
One last thing about Saudi. So, you think that they're just warming up by bombing the crap out of Yemen?
Well, yeah, I think that's one thing too. And you can see that the Saudis as a military force are pathetic because they've attacked a ragtag group of soldiers here, the Houthis, and the Houthis have actually launched attacks into Saudi Arabia and pretty far into Saudi Arabia. They haven't been able to take over any bases, but they've given the Saudis quite a scare. They've managed to bomb the civilian people in Yemen pretty well, but in terms of having a dramatic effect on the war there, they really haven't. So the Saudis are really a weak, pathetic military force. They're a paper tiger in the region. They are like Israel in the sense that they have the backing of the United States, which is why they can do a lot of the things that they do. Unlike Israel, who actually has military hardware and military know-how, they don't seem to be as capable of using it. But they do. Apparently, this bombing, it is a signal that they are willing to engage militarily in the region more and more, and that's going to end up biting the Saudis as well.
Well, Brandon, if you can even believe it, we've managed to talk for an entire hour. A lot to comprehend on a Friday morning, and it sounds like the Middle East is just a complete and utter mess right now, as it has been for the last, what, 10, 12 years, but it's more of a mess now than it's been ever, I think.
Yeah, every country in the Middle East now, except Oman, and I think one could even really debate that, is in a state of war, in some type of state of war. Every country in the Middle East.
So the
So.
Brookings Institute wins.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guess what? We got about 4 seconds left. So, Brandon, you have an awesome Friday. Thank you so much for coming on. You are welcome anytime. It is Friday, so make sure you guys stick around for Friday Night Radio, and we will catch up with you on Monday.